Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics, government, and selfishness went wrong, and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of very personal empowerment, aimed at making each of us more responsible, more cooperative, more aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us to each other, no matter what we find to squabble over in the interim. You can call us toll-free from the U.S. to 877-876-5227. You can call from Canada to 888-810-8322. And you can call us direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if one of those old-fashioned on-the-air stations in your area carries this show, just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as it is humanly possible on the station archives. And my own blog is titled, How the Neocons Stole Freedom, and is conveniently located at howtheneoconsstolefreedom.blogspot.com. Contact me there or here at BBS to get our regular emailings. Now, one of our tasks here at The Spiritual Politician is connecting the dots so that you can see the whole picture. Doing that's scary sometimes, but it allows us to see what's really happening, essential G2. Knowing allows us to choose the alternatives that work to fulfill our spiritual mission. That mission was and remains acting with love toward each other and providing the needed smackdown to those who act inappropriately. On our show today, we'll be connecting some dots for you. Our guest will help with that, and some of those dots are sort of embedded. In case you did not know, in my spare time, I write for the Iconoclast, a paper in Texas that has made it their charge to get the truth out. In 2004, they issued the editorial from Crawford, Texas, that endorsed Kerry because Bush was just too appalling to be believed. In 2005, they provided the moment-by-moment coverage of events at Camp Casey. This week, following the same tradition of innovation, they embedded a very special correspondent in Baghdad. Here's the first report from correspondent Jane Stillwater. Greetings from Kuwait. This post is going to be quick and dirty and not very coherent because I'm writing to you from a Kinko's at the Kuwaiti City Airport. After 2 days on the plane, I arrived here around midnight, and since I can't even begin to try to arrange to get picked up until 6 a.m. tomorrow morning, I'll be spending the rest of the night in a Barca lounger in the airport offices of Kellogg, Brown, and Root. How surrealistic is that? Here's my first dispatch. The Great American Dream Still Exists in Iraq by Jane Stillwell. You know how we all thought that the American economy was going downhill? It's not true. They're just not looking in the right places. Look closer. The 1950s American economic miracle isn't dead. It's still going on. People are still getting well-paying jobs. Mortgages are still being paid off. Jobs are available everywhere. You can find one just for the asking. 3 cars in your garage? No problem. No money worries? No debts? Decent jobs are out there begging. Yes, the 1950s American economic miracle is still happening. Only it's happening in Iraq. How spooky, how weird, how deja vu. While American cities are rotting and American children go to sleep hungry at night, there is still a land far, far away where everything is as it was before our present economic American Easter egg cracked. Where is this simple, illusory holiday place? Iraq. Yesterday, escorted by 2 large, handsome bodyguard cameramen supplied by the San Francisco Chronicle, I took a BART train to the San Francisco airport and boarded a plane to Amsterdam. Jane? Your flight from Amsterdam to Kuwait has been canceled, said the guy at the KLM check-in counter. Would you mind spending a night in Holland? Would I mind? Heck no. But when I got to Amsterdam, they told me something else. Tomorrow's flight has been canceled, but you can get on yesterday's flight.
Huh?
And it leaves in 2 hours. So I trundled off to gate D7, and while I was waiting for yesterday's flight, I chit-chatted with four really nice Department of Defense and Blackwater contractors. They talked about perks. I'm making a fabulous salary. I saved up enough to put my daughters through college, and also my wife. We have a minivan, a sedan, and an SUV. I just got back from a week at Disney World, and next year we're taking the family to Europe. Sounds just like the good old days, doesn't it? Guys working hard, guys getting ahead. On the flight from Holland to Kuwait, the entire plane was filled with contractors pursuing the American dream in Iraq. So am I trying to put an end to this perfect world just because it's based on the quicksand of a million dead bodies? Not I, said this little white duck. On the way to Kuwait, I watched an in-flight movie entitled Bobby about the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. And what RFK said in that film hit the nail exactly on the head. Too often we excuse those who are willing to build their own lives on the shattered dreams of other human beings. P.S. While I was flying across the Atlantic getting leg cramps, eating rubber chicken, and watching Casino Royale, I also read an article in The Guardian about the ghastly slaughter that is happening right now in Darfur. Don't even get me started on that one. Wondering who else is making a profit off all those grisly deaths. Thanks to Jane Stillwater, we know where the money is going. Prosperity flows untrammeled to those working for Halliburton, while here in America we're tightening our belts to the backbone. In her next report, Ms. Stillwater observed that the lavish and delicious food served at the cafeteria she patronized in Kuwait included something less tasty on the menu. I was about to give this place a whole bunch of Michelin stars for sure, and when I finally sat down at my tastefully decorated table and started to eat, I discovered that every wall in the chow hall had at least two giant plasma TVs nailed up next to the air conditioners, and every single one of them was turned to Fox News. Ooh, really kind of turns off your appetite. Thanks, Jane, another dot falls into place. Evidently, good food and money will buy both contractors and most of the media. And now other updates from the week just passed. The issue of SMU and the condos has been remanded to state court. That means the ugly secret that this administration thought would be buried will instead be dug up and heard in open court. Gary Dovica is pleased, and so are we. Vodica is connecting his own set of dots. Stay tuned for more on that. And now our thought for the week ahead. By connecting the dots, we connect ourselves to the truth and to each other. When we know the truth, we see others as they are and let them know what we think of how they are behaving. You can see why this administration would be sort of eager to avoid visibility. The week ahead will bring us to Easter Sunday. Christians believe that Easter marks the moment in time when Christ returned from the dead, giving all humanity the gift of eternal life through him. That's the message of Easter, remember. Think about that this week when you consider what's happening in Iraq and around the world. If we're connected through him, what are we doing to ourselves? Whistleblowers bring our attention to activity that otherwise might never come to light. How does coming forward to speak the truth connect us? Without that truth, connective action is impossible. Whistleblowers help us give those around us the right feedback on what and who they are. How can anyone correct wrong behavior if that behavior remains hidden? When you stop the secrecy, the covert behavior, you assert a visibility and an accountability that brings the guilty up short. Something that's good for all of us. In most instances, shame works better to modify behavior than a lawsuit. Whistleblowers help connect those dots we talked about earlier. Jane Stillwater showed us today where the money went and how they managed to manicure the attitudes of people we thought of as outside the influence of America's corporate media blackout. Knowing that changes our attitudes. Nearly half the personnel now in Iraq are not military. They're contractors working on cost-plus contracts for as much as, brace yourself, $20,000 a month for very middling work. cost plus means Halliburton charges us for all the cost plus more they tack on. So is there a strong economic incentive to keep this war going? You bet there is. Our guest tonight is Captain Eric H. May, a specialist in intelligence who has been deep inside the cadre of power that we've come to know as the neocons. He's written professionally and also been considered for a job as a Bush speechwriter. Insiders see things that make them especially dangerous to the powers that be. Captain May's awareness of what has been going on with those now in the White House began in the mid-90s. That dangerous knowledge forced him to take evasive action to avoid being silenced. He and the people known as the Ghost Troop are working to make Americans aware of what's been happening so that action can be taken to change our direction. It's dangerous work, but Captain May is ready for what comes. Please welcome Captain Eric May. Are you there?
Yes, Melinda, I am. Thank you for having me on.
Well, it's our pleasure, and I know you're going to have a lot to talk about today. But we always start by asking our guests to tell us something about themselves personally. So how about that? Could you tell us a little bit about your past history and where you're from?
Sure, sure. I was born in Houston, Texas. And at the age of 17, I entered my first military tour. I was a specialist in nuclear, biological, and chemical warfare. And stayed at Fort Hood for 3 years. Came out of the Army in 1980 and went to college, the University of Houston Honors College. Majoring in Latin and Greek. After I took my degree in Latin and Greek, I went back into the Army in 1985, this time as an intelligence officer. And since I had an aptitude for languages, pretty quickly I found myself out in the Defense Language Institute in Monterey studying Russian full-time for a couple of years. After that, I was posted a few different places, including D.C., as an intelligence officer, and ultimately wound up back in Houston, where I left active service and joined reserve unit, specializing in doing strategic exercises. It's called the 75th Maneuver Area Command. We specialize in doing tactical and strategic wargaming exercises. As all this was going on, concurrent with all this, I began to write for the newspapers in Houston, Houston Chronicle and Houston Post, as an op-ed writer, specializing in education and then later in military analysis. That brought me into the attention of a lot of media in the area. NBC gave me a contract to be the affiliate editorial writer. I started writing as a freelance writer, what's called a ghost writer, for the corporate market out here, for people like Ken Lay. I did one piece for Colin Powell, wrote some stuff for Hill and Knowlton. And my work as a ghost writer and editorialist brought me to the attention of the Bush people. They interviewed me in 1996. I interviewed with Karen Hughes, who I think now is working with the ambassador, is working in the White House at the State Department, I believe.
Yes.
Karen Hughes at that time was Bush's communications director. I interviewed to become the Bush speechwriter and maintained a lot of contacts with people who were close to the Bush family, most prominently a fellow named Chase Untermyer, now the ambassador to Qatar, where we have Central Command headquarters, who was a correspondent and friend for going on 15 years. And he was my best man at my wedding.
Mm-hmm.
So until I began to take issue with the Bush people and the way they were wrecking the Constitution and setting up the nation, you could say I was on the outside of the inner circle.
I see. Well, that must have given you access to a lot of information that they probably now regret that you have.
Well, yeah, and at the time, of course, I didn't even know that I did have access to it. For instance, I remember before the war started, let's say going back to February of 2003, 1 month before the war started, all of my editorial contacts, my political and corporate contacts in Houston and I were discussing the war. And, for instance, I went out to dinner. My wife and I went out to dinner with Chase Untermyer, the guy who's now the ambassador for Bush, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember sitting there over Chinese food with chopsticks, kind of the two of us being military men. He had been the assistant secretary of the Navy, and I'd been a humble captain, but a humble captain who was pretty intelligent in his field. we were sitting over kind of drawing out with chopsticks a map of the Middle East, and both of us were saying that this was not an Iraq-focused war. This was a Middle East war, with Iraq simply being the first step. My guess was that we were going to go Iraq, then we were going to take a left and go to Syria next. And he said his maintained, no, we're going to hit Iraq, then I think Iran would be the next best target. And at the time, I remember laughing at this as if we were playing a game of a board game or something. And it's a war game.
Yeah.
Little did I realize that, of course, he had inside information, and Iran was a long-term target of the war aim. Now, ironically enough, immediately after we hit Iraq and after the Battle of Baghdad and the fall of Saddam Hussein, you may remember, going back to 2003, that immediately the Bush people started saying, oh, the WMDs that we couldn't find, well, they've been evacuated to Syria. And sure enough, the administration began to pound the war drums for an incursion of Syria. That didn't work out because Iraq turned into quicksand, the word I believe you used earlier to describe it.
Yes.
But so it's interesting. A lot of the central Bush plan I was in on from the start. I'll give you one more example.
So let's be clear. You're saying that this plan for this war actually started while he was still governor of Texas.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Oh, no. This war started before we started the first Iraq war, Operation Desert Storm. Remember, at the end of Desert Storm, there was a loud group of people, we could call them now the proto-neocons, who believed that we should have continued after defeating Iraqi forces in Kuwait. Their view was that we should have kept rolling right up the Euphrates Valley until we took Baghdad.
And they were very angry with...
Say again?
They were very angry with the first Bush that he didn't do it.
Right. Now, the peculiar thing, and this is one of the minor paradoxes of my position, is that at the time I was a general staff officer in Houston and writing for the Houston Chronicle, doing military analysis for them, I wrote a piece within about 6 months of the end of Operation Desert Storm, this being August 1992 that I published the piece, in which I defended Bush 41, by saying in the piece, it's well read now on the internet, anyone can find it in Captain May published essays. I maintain in the piece that had we gone into Iraq, we would have lost our international support, this being 1991. Had we gone into Iraq then, we would have lost international support. We would have wound up against sectarian and tribal factions. We would have wound up in the middle of a religious civil war, and it would have turned into a second Vietnam. So essentially, you know, not many officers can say they went on record predicting that Iraq would turn into exactly what it has turned into. But I predicted that back in 1991. Now, the paradox of that is that in 1991, that was consensus. The entire military structure, the military command, was in agreement. That was the Bush position in 91. But that had we gone into Iraq, we would have wound up, there's no holding a tar baby, something you can't get rid of. Neocons are the X factor between that good political, geopolitical consensus of 1991, which said, for God's sake, leave Iraq alone, to the position of 2003, when we believed, and we have to go back to the beginning of war, in 2003, the corporate media had us believing, in their role as propagandists for the administration, that we were going to have a three-week war, we were going to have the soldiers back by the end of the summer, which would have been 6 months from the invasion, and we were going to have dollar-a-gallon gasoline. Iraq was going to embrace democracy, and, you know, girls were going to be wearing bikinis, for all I know. That's what they really promised us.
Yeah, it was going to be a matter of glory for everybody, yes. Now, the neocons don't tend to be military people.
Oh, no. They're chicken hawks, and they're gutless wonders. See, the neocons are, I guess the best word I could use for them would be that they're corporate Machiavels. And this whole war was the neocon faction that led us to this war. Threw up the document. I'd say the Mein Kampf of this war being called the Global War on Terror, but that in itself is just a Machiavellian manipulation of language, meaning global war equals world war. The global war on terror always equaled World War III. The neocons knew that from the get-go. So the document that was the Mein Kampf of this next world war was called the Project for a New American Century.
PNAC.
Restructuring America's Defenses.
Mm-hmm.
A document accepted by, written up by people like Bill Kristol, a lot of neocon media types, a lot of Department of Defense stalwarts. It was a kind of Wolfowitz, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Bill Kristol. These people wrote up a document which really put it on the line. It formalized what had been going around in the hidden corridors of power since the end of Desert Storm, since the first incursion in the Middle East. That view being that there was an opportunity for the United States to go in and swoop up the Middle East. Before China developed the military muscle to stop us, while Russia, the former Soviet Union, was in decline and wasn't interested in trying to stop our adventure. And then in doing that, we control the 21st century.
And so what they really wanted...
put an end to all the many problems that Israel had in the region, because we would democratize and liberalize the region. So everything, it was kind of like a Santa Claus letter. The
That's
war
what I was
plan
say, a wish
was
list.
Yes, it was a wish list. And it was a wish list written up by people who, I would suppose, their greatest assets were they were connected to the military-industrial process, although not as professional soldiers, as manipulators of that process, and they were connected to the media propaganda apparatus, which we call the free media, which isn't free.
Right.
So those people who were conceptualists and theorists went into a world war posture. It was always intended to be a world war, and the two main objectives, in fact, I've heard it eloquently stated by Pentagon statesmen later as OIL. It was OIL was going to be the code word for it. Originally, they proposed to call it not Operation Iraqi Freedom, OIF, but Operation Iraqi Liberation, OIL.
And then they actually said, well, maybe that would be too telling, right?
It was too telling, so they didn't use it. And then the three criteria, the three desiderata, the things that we went for, the mission objectives were OIL. And that meant oil, Israel, and logistics. The logistics at the end meant that we were going to build Iraq up and use it as a platform to attack the rest of the Middle East. You know, you can go left to the west and go after Syria, or you can go right to the west. I'm sorry, back that up. You can go right to the east and hit Iran, or you can go left to the west and hit Syria. So the neocons were so presumptive that we've got to think about this as something that's going to be called a monumental fiasco by history. You know, even if you believe in war, this was bad war strategy. The neocons were so hubristic that they really thought that the right way to attack the Middle East was to jump into the middle of it with hostile countries on all sides. Which is, I mean, no second lieutenant in his first command in the military would make that tactical mistake. But that mistake became our grand strategic vision.
Well, they were used to board games,
the neocon,
so they didn't understand.
And it makes sense of things like the conversation I had with Ambassador Untermyer back before the war started, when we were talking about whether this world war was going to go left or right. It was obvious enough that that's what it was. In fact, my first insight that there was going to be a war started the day after 9/11. I remember talking to two people, Frank Michel, the associate editor of the Houston Chronicle, and then Chase Untermyer, at that time head of public relations for Compaq Computers. This is before he went back into government as ambassador to Qatar. And I asked, do you think 9/11, this is before I had any clue on what 9/11 was or what the motives were. I really thought it was 19 Arabs with box cutters at this point. I asked, do you think that the military-industrial complex and the Israel lobby are going to use this as an excuse to lead us into a world war? And the peculiar thing by these two men of power and consequence was that neither one of them said, oh, you're crazy thinking there's a military-industrial complex, or, oh, you're crazy thinking there's an Israel lobby, or, oh, you're crazy thinking that these things could conspire to lead us into war. Neither one of them took that tack. Both of them gave the following answers. Frank Michel said, I think it's a 1 in 4, and Chase Untermyer said it was 1 in 5. And I said it was 50-50.
Well, I guess you were
I didn't
were closer,
realize
huh?
at the time that 9/11 wasn't an accident that fell into the lap of the neocons so that they could do it. 9/11 was what the neocons had mandated in their document, Restructuring America's Defenses, the Project for a New American Century, when they said that this world moved to take over the 21st century by grabbing the key resource of the 21st century, the oil regions, would be predicated upon a new Pearl Harbor, a catalyzing event. They stated in the Project for a New American Century, Restructuring America's Defenses, only about an 80-page document, if anyone wants to look it up on the Internet, they stated that the easiest way to get this geopolitical plan going, this advantageous world domination move, was to have a new Pearl Harbor. And which, of course, brings us to Bush on the night of 9/11, writing in his official diary, we have just experienced the Pearl Harbor of the 21st century.
Well, that's exactly the way that they always get us into war. Right? That's sort of the traditional approach. They did the same thing to get us into war with the Manila. Well, you know,
the battleship that blew up.
Yes.
You know, a battleship mysteriously blew up. We immediately blamed the Spaniards. Decades later, we admitted to the Spaniards that they had nothing to do with it and said it must have been an accident. At this point, I take a rather cynical view of world affairs, particularly when it comes to war, and I suspect the USS Maine was what we're talking about 9/11 being, a false flag attack, meaning something that you set up so that you can blame another party. The best example being that if you and I are next-door neighbors and call the fire department, you call the dog pound of my dog, well, what I do is I go out some night and I shoot my own dog, and then I call the cops on you and say you did it.
That's right.
You're already linked to being hostile to my dog. My dog's dead. The weight of evidence immediately goes against you. That's a false flag attack.
Yes, absolutely, and that's exactly what you could see. And that case has been made over and over that that's what happened with 9/11. But in the wake of 9/11, they moved very rapidly. I mean, we went through a month period where there was a tremendous outpouring of sympathy for America, and you could see us moving toward the place where we could even think about world peace because there was such an outpouring and such a sense of disgust about what had happened. And they did everything they could to make sure that that didn't happen. They immediately started the bombarding Afghanistan.
Right, which was another, if you go back far into the same neocon annals, you'll find that Afghanistan really was all about Caspian Sea oil.
Yeah.
Afghanistan happened to be key terrain for controlling the emerging natural gas and Caspian Sea oil reserves. And, in fact, who was it? Someone, I think Michael Moore, that's right, in Fahrenheit 9/11, points out that the military bases that were set up in Afghanistan, following the American incursion into Afghanistan, precisely guard the route proposed for the Caspian oil pipeline.
Yes. The whole thing is so patently obvious.
Yeah, it had all the... If you look at it historically, of course, we're caught in the middle of this mass of propaganda. The mass media is nothing but the mass propaganda media. It's simply corporate controlled instead of state controlled. But the effects and the techniques are no different. But attacking Afghanistan because we were after Al Qaeda, which was supported by the Taliban. That's going to seem 100 years from now about as intelligent as saying we attacked Alaska because of polar bears.
That's right.
I mean, Alaska had a pipeline that we wanted to build. Had we attacked and slaughtered the polar bears to build the pipeline, then blamed it on the polar bears for knocking down the World Trade Center, it would have been the same argument.
We are getting the polar bears.
Well, that's true. We'll get them all one way or another. That's what it means to be an American nowadays.
That's why the whole world
hates us, you know, this kind of heavy-handed strategy. And remember, the whole world, the world, when we say the world responded with great outpouring of sympathy for the United States, what we're talking about primarily is the first world, the European world, still the white man's world, if you want to put it in those terms,
where
the media is controlled by the same cartelization that controls the American media.
Well, now what was happening with you in 2000? I mean, in 2001, you wondered. In 2002, you must have gone through a period of understanding what was really going on. Was there sort of an aha moment for you?
Well, far to the contrary, about those 2 years, there was an aha moment. But let me tell you how much of a sucker I was. Just that people will say, you know, my God, you know, Captain May, you speak four or five languages, you can't be fooled. Not at all. Intellectuals are the easiest people to fool a lot of times. I believe the mass media accounts of 9/11 implicitly. I volunteered to renew my commission and go back on active service to fight in the upcoming war in 2002. In fact, mm-hmm. I tried to get Chase Untermyer to pull some strings with the Department of Defense to get me back in. I really was gung-ho at that point. I wrote an op-ed for the Houston Chronicle discussing why it was that I thought Al-Qaeda was most likely to strike the Houston area with a terrorist attack next. I put us mm-hmm. at the top of the targeting. All these things as we were going our way toward the war. Now, concurrent with being deluded about things like, who did 9/11 and whether we need to go to war, I was having some very intelligent observations. I remember in the same February 2003 time frame, as we were obviously mobilizing to attack Iraq, going to a brunch with some of my editor buddies, and saying that I thought Iraq was going to turn into a long-term war. It wasn't going to be over quickly. This was so much against the current wisdom in those days that in the entire group of editorial, corporate, political people, there was no one there who would entertain the idea. In fact, I remember specifically asking, am I the only one at this table in this room who believes we're still going to be fighting that war in the summer?
Well, those people didn't have a military background. They didn't know.
Well, even people who did. We have to understand the power of groupthink. There was so much riding on a successful war in the Middle East that those people in the media or people in politics or people in corporate or people in general always want to say that they're thinking independently, but they're usually thinking conveniently. And there was mm-hmm. so much convenience in the illusion that we were going to win that war quickly and reap all the advantages to go with it. We were going to control the oil. We were going to boost the American economy. We were going to secure Israel's position against its Muslim enemies. You know, we were going to take care of so many things that so many people remember. This was on the wish list of so many people. In fact, I'd say this was on the wish list of everybody who was what you would call a serious political player, that they simply weren't capable of thinking that it might not be so. But before the war, I remember thinking that this was going to get rough. And then shortly after the war had started, as we were doing the 3-week charge up the Euphrates to go to Baghdad, I got
right.
in touch with an old professor of mine who had also been part of this kind of war hysteria. He'd been a captain like me, a captain in the Wehrmacht, in Hitler's army. He was, a drafted asset when the Germans decided to go to war against Poland. And we discussed the American war plan and the American propaganda effort, and this gentleman, now deceased, Dr. Peter Gunther, he and I came to an agreement that it was basically the German World War plan being warmed up again, and this time to be used against the Middle East. And I wrote a piece on April Fool's Day. I turned it into the Chronicle, April Fool's Day 2003, about a week before we got to Baghdad, in which I predicted that we would wind up in a quicksand war and it might turn into a world war. It might even come home to us. Now, at this point, every one of those tenets is branded. The neocons themselves are saying we're in World War III. The neocons themselves are saying that we're going to be hit. Remember, Al-Qaeda is going to hit us is the new propaganda line. Neocons themselves are saying this has turned into an interminable, they call it a generational war. But at the time, those sentiments that I put in my op-ed to the Chronicle were so radical that I remember my editor, the op-ed editor, David Langworthy of the Houston Chronicle, calling me on the phone on April 2nd, and saying, Eric, I'm going to run it tomorrow, April 3rd. I'm going to run it because you're about the only person in the nation who's making this argument. And furthermore, I got to run it tomorrow because by April 4th, the Army's going to reach Baghdad and disprove everything you've written. They're going to make you look ridiculous. Now, that brings us to when you asked if there was an epiphany moment for me. Understand that up to this point in time, I was merely writing as a military analyst by training, and that I hadn't opened my eyes to some of the diabolical aspect of how we got into this war. It was the next day after I published that piece, April 3rd in the Chronicle, again, which anyone can read by Googling Captain May published essays. It was the next day that we reached Baghdad, and that was my epiphany. Part of my background, in addition to military intelligence, was public affairs. I was a division public affairs officer trained at Defense Information School by the military.
Mm-hmm.
It became apparent to me on the night, Friday, April 4th here in the States, that would have been Saturday morning, April 5th in Iraq, that our plan for taking Baghdad, which is, if you can remember back this far, we said we were going to circle Baghdad and kind of take it slowly.
Right.
All of a sudden, we wake up Saturday morning, a guy named, Baghdad Bob, he was called, the Iraqi information minister, was saying that the Iraqi forces had countered us at the Baghdad airport and killed hundreds of us, and that the airport was still being contested. Well, the night that that claim came out, that I say the morning in Iraq, the night, because we were watching it Friday night in the United States, I was making the exact same conclusion from what I was seeing.
Uh-huh.
We can look at it inferentially. What most people will remember, it's almost like somebody slipped a Mickey into our drinks that night. Think about it this way. We went up to Baghdad, took 3 weeks. We circled Baghdad saying there was going to be a long siege. And then all of a sudden, the next thing we know, we wake up the next morning, Baghdad Bob is claiming that there's been a big fight at the Baghdad airport. The U.S. got the worst of it. And then the next thing you know, all we're talking about for 3 days is Private Jessica Lynch.
Yes, I remember that. All of a sudden, a switch.
Now, it's kind of like this. Again, think of war as a game. I don't mean to be brutal. It's just that, I was a professional. So think of it as any kind of strategic game. Let's think of it as a Super Bowl. The U.S.
Mm-hmm.
is playing Iraq in the Super Bowl called the Iraq War. We make the long drive all the way 300 miles up to Baghdad. Taking Baghdad is like making the touchdown, right?
Yeah.
Okay, it's the Super Bowl. We're on the 1 yard line, which means we just surrounded Baghdad. Why on earth do all the cameras at the Super Bowl suddenly switch to a cheerleader called Jessica Lynch and we don't get to see the play? If you were watching the football game and your team had the ball on the other guy's 1 yard line, you would not want to be watching cheerleaders. You'd want to be watching the play, right?
Well, then that means
so why
that there's
we
something
see the
they don't want you
and
to
the
do.
The reason
yes.
was Baghdad Bob was telling it straight. It did turn into a nightmare. The Baghdad airport turned into a six-hour fight where elements of the 3rd Infantry Division and the 37th Cavalry, their scout unit, were overwhelmed by Fedayeen, Saddam, and Republican Guard forces. That battle went on for the whole night. The Iraqis
mm-hmm.
did not just hand us Baghdad. That was part of the myth. Jessica Lynch was brought up as a distraction so that the American public wouldn't realize that you could say the Iraqis lost in the Battle of Baghdad, but they exploded the myth of American invincibility, and they shot to hell any notion that the Iraqis were just going to roll over and become Democrats and Republicans, or better yet, neocons.
Yes, that was
because they fought tooth and toenail. There were between 3,000 and 5,000 entrenched, prepared Iraqi ambush positions in the city. Now, none of this, again, came out. The American media uniformly knocked out the real picture and put up the Jessica Lynch thing. You remember at the same time that the U.S. Army, undoubtedly an artist in the White House, shelled and killed Al Jazeera's correspondents.
Yes,
who were broadcasting
I remember
from.
That. And
yeah,
at the time, it seemed very strange that the focus had shifted so much that she didn't see more than just...
Again, even now, it's been 4 years. We're coming up on the 4th anniversary of the Battle of Baghdad, which happened April 5th through 8th. Even now, to the average listener, to the layman who's listening to our broadcast, whom I'm assuming was not a general staff officer, but had some concepts and common sense, it's absurd when you think about it in retrospect that we could have had a battle to take the capital city, which there must have been. I mean, we know inferentially that they were fighting us all the way to Baghdad. the thing told the public at the time, which the public swallowed because it was coming out uniformly from the mass media, was that the Iraqis had rolled over. Oh, yawn, yawn, take a sip of beer and don't worry about the Battle of Baghdad. Let's look at the rescue of one private first class named Jessica Lynch. It's absurd on the face of it. Why, I mean, war gets a whole lot of private first classes killed. Why did the rescue of one PFC become the focus of that weekend's war coverage? And the only answer available is, as Sherlock Holmes says, when you've eliminated all the other options, whatever remains, however unlikely, must be the answer. The obvious answer is that there really was a war going on in the background, and the media, the U.S. media, really decided to block it out from the public view.
What happened? You had an epiphany. You understood that something had happened, and you eventually came to a conclusion. What happened?
Well, when I found out that the Battle of Baghdad had gone down, for a couple of weeks, I waited because I thought the media would. I thought it possible that the operation had been blacked out because of arrangements with the media and the military, and that it would be, you know, covered up for 24 hours, 72 hours, a week maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually something that was within the realm of military law, what's called the Defense Department's Principles of Information. So what I did for a couple of weeks is I took up a fund for the fallen soldiers of Baghdad. And what was amazing about that was that no one would give any money to the fallen soldiers of Baghdad because nobody knew the soldiers had fallen in Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
About three weeks after Baghdad, April 22nd, I decided to go out and go to the home base of the unit that had taken the brunt of the casualties, the 3rd Infantry Division from Fort Stewart, Georgia. So I actually, at that point, I was very athletic. I took a 1,000-mile bicycle tour. I do those occasionally. And I rode 3 weeks from Texas to Georgia, about 50 miles a day, just kind of taking the pulse of people along the way. And it was very interesting to see the mood of the United States in those early days of the post-Baghdad war when we thought we had won. When I got to Fort Stewart, I talked to one of the division chaplains, Colonel Neil Dennington, and he confirmed for me that the Battle of Baghdad had taken place, there had been heavy casualties, and it had been covered up. Further, he told me that this war was a much bigger war than was being reported to the public. The public was being propagandized into supporting it, and there would be reprisals for anybody who got in the way of the propaganda effort. So that told me we were playing World War rules. I mean, that confirmed my worst suspicions, that the entire structure of the U.S. government had become mobilized for a world war, and the Constitution was in the can.
Mm-hmm.
I came home from that Fort Stewart epiphany, or confirmation of my April epiphany. Remember, I saw Baghdad go down. I knew what was happening. It wasn't until I got to Fort Stewart that military officials who had been there confirmed what my suspicions were. I came home and sat around for a couple of months wondering what to do. And it wasn't until late June 2003 that at this point, in late June, it had become apparent to the establishment that the neocon war plan had fallen on its butt. And it was a total boondoggle. And people who were in the know knew in 2003 summer that this had turned into Vietnam. Well, General Wesley Clark, I suppose you've heard of him, CNN's Crossfire on June 25th, 2003, and said the whole thing, which was that the neocons had always wanted this war. 9/11 just provided an excuse to do the war they wanted. The war aim was to get hold of the oil resources and take care of Israel's geopolitical problems before China could get big enough to stand up to us in the region. When Wesley Clark came out on the 25th of June to say that, there were a lot of critics like me who decided that it was a fair game on the Bush people, that it was okay to attack the administration. So I published my last, let's get a chronology here. There's a fellow named David Kelly in the U.K., Dr. David Kelly. He was a weapons of mass destruction expert for Tony Blair. He began to talk with the BBC about how the British government had, quote-unquote, sexed up its information to lead the country to war. Joe Wilson, David Kelly started doing this in early July 2003. Joe Wilson published a piece, What I Didn't Find in Niger, in the New York Times on July 6th, which said the same thing David Kelly was saying, which is that the governments of his country, in David Kelly's case the UK, and in Joe Wilson's case the USA, had sexed up the information. They'd come up with bogus information to go to war. 2 days later, my editors at the Chronicle allowed me to publish my last Chronicle op-ed, which was still worried about the quicksand of war in Iraq. Again, anyone can find it at Captain May published essays. In that piece, I attacked the Bush war plan as being a failure and leading us to a new Vietnam. So in the course of 2 weeks, everything from the former NATO commander, Wesley Clark, to former Ambassador Joe Wilson, to weapons of mass destruction expert Joe Wilson, all the way to me, you know, not by any means as illustrious a name as those people, but a well-connected military expert in Bush's hometown of Houston, remember, had all kicked Bush in the knees hard for a failed war. What happened next, and this is what kind of leads us to the precipice that changed my whole world. So I came back from Fort Stewart ready to do something. I found my chance to do something in July. Those of us who attacked Bush in early July never dreamed that Bush was going to counterattack. The next week, this being about July 8th, Ministry of Defense officials arrest Dr. David Kelly, work him over for 3 days, and they feed him to Parliament. You may remember the Parliament.
I remember that, yeah.
Where Kelly was being asked by the opposition parties, don't you feel like you're being made a fall guy? Don't you believe you're being set up? Weren't you telling the truth to the BBC? And all poor Kelly could do was sit there and hold his head in his hands and say, I can't say, I can't say. I can't tell, I can't tell. So he was clearly under pressure. Joe Wilson was counterattacked by Rove and Libby. In fact, this has now become the Libby case.
Yes.
The real story behind the Libby case was that Libby, Cheney, and Rove sicked Robert Novak on Joe Wilson's wife. Remember, they called like 8 different neocon-friendly journalists trying to get Joe Wilson's wife attacked, this being about the 10th of July. By the time of the end of the next week, Bush took a junket to Africa. Now, this is one of the more amazing things. Bush, in the middle of the greatest war challenge he had had, in the middle of a national debate which was turning against him, with the war going wrong, George W. Bush got on an airplane and went off to Africa for a week. And the reason for that was they wanted to get Bush out of town while they got things set up. Tony Blair and Bush both got out of town. Here in the States, in the UK, they went after Kelly. As we say, they arrested him. They put him up before Congress. In the States, they went after Joe Wilson's wife. My friends began to tell me, look out, things might be getting dangerous. And I actually decided to go underground on the 16th of July, 2 days after Joe Wilson's wife was outed in the Robert Novak column. The next day, David Kelly wound up suicided. He wound up killed by the government. I mean, people will remember that David Kelly was called a suicide. He slashed his wrist in a park.
Right.
David Kelly had predicted that he would be killed, he would be assassinated, and it would be made to be looking like a suicide. So, it turned into, I think, within a day of the time that I went underground, David Kelly, another war critic, was dead. And at that point, everybody realized that the people, the neocons who had pushed for the war, in order to keep the war going, were going to start assassinating people. So,
that was my rude awakening to
the realities of what was going on. Not only was the constitutional principle of the First Amendment in the tank, meaning that propaganda was being freely foisted on the American people, Baghdad being the first case where I knew of that, although now I realize 9/11 itself was the same thing, but at the time, Baghdad was my big epiphany. So not only were they violating the First Amendment, but they were committing murders to keep people from saying they were violating the First Amendment. So political
and so that really that was your epiphany when you realized that you weren't safe yourself either.
Yeah, well, particularly because the night that David Kelly was killed, the 17th, again, I was in hiding, but I was watching TV. That's when Bush came back from Africa and Tony Blair suddenly came over to the United States. This is the first time Blair had been to the United States during the war. And they did a press conference, and in the joint press conference, they took about two questions. And the second question is, what are you going to do about all the criticism of the war, you know, the idea that you trumped up a war? And Bush looked at the camera very curtly and said, we're going to address the issue. And they turned, he and Blair looked at each other, turned on their heels, and walked off the stage. And it was at that exact moment that David Kelly was assassinated. The next night, Bush was coming to Houston. He'd suddenly made a change in plans when he was going to come to Houston. My great concern was that being his foremost Houston critic and having criticized him so publicly, you just got to look at it this way. If the White House was willing to break all the rules to attack his wife, if Ken Downing Street was willing to assassinate a chief WMD expert who had national credentials, how much danger was I in Houston for mucking with the Bush war plan in his hometown paper? And I thought considerable.
Well, so, I'm sure you were.
Yeah, that was the thought among my connections was that when Bush came to town, one of the things he was going to take care of was going to be me. Not meaning he personally, but someone in his entourage.
He's such a chicken hawk, he would never do that.
Well, you know, I mean, he's psychopathic and he's murderous. It's just like he's like a bad chick character out of Machiavelli. He's an evil prince. He's an evil, weak prince who inherited his power through his father. You know, he's got there's a kind of Bush mafia, and he's there's an old saying that in the Bush family, Jeb out in Florida, okay, old man Bush is the godfather. Jeb in Florida, whom they got a governor's job, was going to be Michael, but George Jr., George W., is kind of a cross between Sonny with his hot head and Fredo with his stupidity.
Yes.
So they got the worst possible godfather's son into the position of being the new godfather.
Then that's exactly what happened. And of course,
3 was full of reprisals to get everybody in line. And it was at the same time, by the way, the situation in Iraq by then had become so desperate. Remember, we planned for a 3-week war and a 6-month occupation. And Wolfowitz was out there crowing about how Iraq was going to pay for itself by the end of the year. Well, we found ourselves in quicksand, just as I predicted in the Chronicle essays. And that's why, by the end of the summer, we started Gitmoizing Abu Ghraib. We started applying torture rules. The idea was that we were going to do anything it took to win that war, and the only way to win that war was to break every rule in the rules of warfare. So that was when Iraq became just the dirty, horrible mess that it has been ever since.
Yeah.
And along the way, anybody military particularly who has gotten in the way and been loud enough about getting in the way of what is a criminal war.
There's so much that's happened. We're running out of time. Could you give people your site again and let them know where they can go find out more about what you've said? Because we've barely scratched the surface.
Well, everything we have just talked about is going to be at... when I said Captain May published essays, that's one chapter of a greater work called The Ghost Troop Introduction. Ghost Troop, my unit, was named in honor of the unacknowledged dead from the Iraq War, specifically beginning with the Battle of Baghdad, when hundreds of U.S. soldiers died and were not given credit. So if they look at the Ghost Troop Introduction, they'll find the more detailed description of everything we've talked about with the summer of 2003. If they want to know my general works, the best thing to do is just simply Google the phrase Ghost Troop Captain May or Google Captain May.
We've
got about 5 million hits internationally on our work. My stuff has gotten published all the way from... I can't publish in the American media anymore, not because I was wrong, but because I was right. I get published aljazeera.info. I've been picked up in russia.ru. Now if I write an article, it gets translated internationally and everything from Portuguese to, you know, Vietnamese. Captain May or Ghost Troop Captain May, you'll find a whole library of my works.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much. I mean, the American people really need to know this. And I know there's several articles about you also on the Iconoclast.
Captain May Iconoclast is a good Google search phrase, or good search phrase, because Leon Smith, who, if there were really any integrity in the American media, would receive the Pulitzer for heroic journalism.
Amen, he would have. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Captain May.
It's been a great pleasure, Melinda. Let's talk again sometime.
Yes, soon. You take care. God bless.
You too.
And that's our show for today, Friday, March 30th, 2007. You go take a look. You're going to find out many things. And now, as we always do, we close our show with America's mission statement. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That when any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter it or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom, and may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.